afternoon. This is Chair Ruth Richardson. Pursuant to House Rule 10.01, I call this remote meeting of the Education Policy Committee to order. The clerk will take the roll for attendance.
Chair Richardson?
Present.
Vice Chair Hassan?
Present.
Representative Erickson?
Erickson, present.
Representative Bennett? Representative Berg?
Present.
Representative Bowe?
Bowe is present.
Representative Christensen?
Present.
Representative Drazkowski? Representative Edelson?
Present.
Representative Feist?
Present.
Representative Frazier?
Present.
Representative Jordan is excused. Representative Keeler?
Keeler, present.
Representative Mueller?
Present.
Representative Mueller?
Mueller, present.
Representative Poston?
Present.
Representative Scott? Representative Erdahl?
Present.
Representative Wasilewicz?
Wasilewicz, present.
Madam Chair, quorum is present.
Thank you. Next up on the agenda, we have the approval of the minutes from the March 21st meeting. Representative Erickson, have you had an opportunity to review those minutes?
Madam Chair, I move approval of the minutes for March 21, 2022.
Thank you. Members, this will be a voice vote. If you could unmute, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The minutes are approved. The first bill on the agenda for today is House File 4233, a Representative Edelson bill. Representative Edelson, would you like to move House File 4233 to be referred to the Committee on Education Finance?
Yes, I would like to move that bill to Education Finance Chair.
Members will have a time certain into this discussion at 1:20 p.m. Representative Edelson, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My twin sons were born very early. They have IEPs, and they've had them their entire life, from preschool to now they're in sixth grade. So I have gotten the opportunity to see the amazing work that special education teachers have provided them and gave witness to how the process works. I've also met many amazing special education teachers from across the state based on my work here at the legislature. Nationally, we have almost 600,000 fewer teachers today than we did before the pandemic. And the number one reason special education teachers are leaving the profession is because they have to take their paperwork obligations home with them. Our highest teacher shortage across the state is in special education. The increased caseloads, paperwork requirements, and challenges of teaching during the pandemic are driving the teachers out of this profession. Everyone is in agreement that our students in special education have a constitutional and a moral right to a public education, and they agree with what has been set forth in the Individuals with Disability Act. That said, if we want to keep our incredibly dedicated special education teachers in the classroom, we as a state need to come up with meaningful solutions to help districts and teachers. As a mom with kids with special needs, I know how important due process is. I need to know that my sons and their are getting the interventions and they're being documented and all those needs are being met appropriately. But I also don't want to rely on a system where special education teachers are expected to spend their nights and weekends away from their own families. Our kids with special needs deserve each and every service they receive. Let's make sure that teachers who provide these invaluable services are also thought of in this important work. Madam Chair, I would like to move with to my several testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Edelson. Testifiers, welcome to the committee. Just as a reminder, testifiers will have 2 minutes each to speak, and our committee administrator will keep time in the chat. You'll get a 30-second warning and also when you are at time. First up, we have Ann Tozer. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, everyone. My name is Ann Tozer. I'm currently in my 14th year as a special educator and my 9th year in Edina Public Schools. I work at the elementary level in a resource room setting. I'm here today to advocate for special educators to be given more due process time built into their school day. This change will have a direct impact on student progress and achievement for our most unique learners. I'd like to start by saying that the due process required for special education ensures that our learners have highly qualified individuals generating unique plans for learning. This time is used to meet with families, consult with specialized instructional staff, assess individual student needs, observe and work with students directly, and then sit down to a computer to write an individual education plan and other supporting documents to make sure students have a plan for progress that will ensure growth. By having built-in due process time, special educators will have the necessary time to assess students, write transition plans, and be able to use more of their prep and professional learning time for designing lessons and reviewing data in a meaningful way. Students in special education should have specialized instructions and lessons to further their progress, and when educators are managing this with hours of paperwork on nights and weekends, it's hard to achieve a balance between the two. My district does have due process time negotiated into our contract, and it helps. Not every district has this type of support. I believe that everyone in the system is doing the best they can, and we really do need your support on this issue. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Stacey Schroeder. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
I am Stacey Schroeder. I am a special education teacher in Moorhead, Minnesota. This is my 23rd year of teaching in an elementary classroom. I really support this bill because I really feel like the due process is the majority of our work during our school day. It's a legal document. It needs to be completed for specific timelines. It can't be put off. It needs to be done when students are in the building. This due process paperwork includes meeting with parents, testing students, completing observations, writing evaluations, writing IEPs. On average, a typical evaluation could take up to 15 hours to complete, and an IEP could take up to 5 hours to complete. When you consider caseload of 20 students, you can see how much time during the day it takes to write these reports. That's a lot of prep time taken away where we could be working on lesson planning and doing day-to-day work with students. Another issue we have in our district is hiring teachers that don't have a license or on a variance. They aren't able to complete all that due process paperwork if they don't have the right license. So that then comes on the teachers that have those licenses. So we're doing additional paperwork, additional due process in completing their work for them. That's by no means a bad thing. I mean, we want them to learn to complete this paperwork, but it's just one more thing that we have to do on a day-to-day basis. This doesn't leave a lot of time during the day for lesson planning and preparing for small groups. That's usually done after hours or on the weekends when teachers are burnt out, they're tired, they're taking care of their own families. So really the students that are most vulnerable are the ones that are missing out on the support they need and being able to program for them the best that we can.
Thank you for your testimony. We will move on to public testimony. We had one individual sign up. Maren Halden, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you so much, Chair Richardson. My name is Maren Halden. I'm an attorney at Legal Aid, which includes the Minnesota Disability Law Center. And I'm a product of Moorhead Public Schools. So thank you, Ms. Schroeder. And the Disability Law Center provides free legal services to kids and adults across the state who have disabilities. And I served as a staff attorney there for several years, representing individual students on school-related issues. And what that usually, when a parent would call our office, the first thing I would do is ask the school for records. So I have spent countless hours reading the special education documents that special education teachers and school psychologists so dutifully prepare. And they're a lot, and they are important. I'm really grateful to Representative Edelson for bringing this bill, which would help ensure that teachers have time to complete these important documents. Many of our clients are kids who are struggling in school. That's why their families contact our office. And so for all students who have disabilities, and especially for students who are experiencing challenges, the communication documents prepared by school staff are a really important way that parents are informed about how their student is doing. This is really critical for parent participation in the IEP process. These documents help parents understand how their student is doing on goals, present levels of achievement, and other progress reports. And all of that information and evaluations and other observations and assessments informs the IEP team and their planning so that the child can receive a free, appropriate public education. But it takes time to gather and prepare this information. And teachers need time to complete these important documents. When they don't have time, sometimes families see in the documents that, you know, things that can harm their relationship or lose trust of the school. And it's not that, you know, I would spend time trying to explain to clients, you know, yep, they didn't use the right gender for your kid, but they are doing a lot of these at once. And that's not that they don't care, but you know, when a kid is struggling and a family is already having a hard time, it can be hard to understand that. So thank you so much for bringing this bill. We really think it's important for teachers to have this time.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, I'll just note that we have available for questions Heather Matthews, who's a special education teacher with District 196, the Rosemont Apple Valley and the Egan School District. Moving on to member questions, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple questions for the author, Representative Edelson. Representative Edelson, I certainly know from experience of having been in the public school, how much paperwork teachers have to do for special education. But my question is, and based on what Ms. Tozer said, why is it that you're mandating something that's part of collective bargaining?
Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Erickson, I think it's a really good question. So what we've heard is inconsistencies throughout the state of Minnesota. So Edina, you know, we apply the sub method. Well, not every district is doing that. And what we do know is it's inconsistent across the board. What we're trying to provide is a consistent framework for our teachers who are, they are exhausted, especially special education teachers. And I know, Representative Erickson, you are a teacher. You know how critical that relationship is. Ms. Tozer actually was my son's caseworker and also teacher. And I can tell you that they formed such an incredible relationship with her. If we lose these consistent, amazing teachers from the field, I think we have a big problem. So I think this is, we're trying to take a wide approach to deal with this issue.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Edelson, though we believe in local control and all of our contracts are bargained between the teacher union and the school board. So if we take that away, we have stepped deeper into government control of even our collective bargaining to the extent of due process time. So I hope that you think carefully about this as you proceed with this proposal, because to me, that is such a violation of the separation between an elected board and the hired employees, the professionals that I was part of, the teaching staff. My second question, Madam Chair, if I may indulge, is have you talked, Representative Edelson, to the Department of Education, who is supposed to have reduced the paperwork that is not required by federal law? Have you talked to them, and what are they doing about it? Because we have worked on this for years, and we have sent message after message, including stipulations in the statute that they need to reduce paperwork. So, you know, what have you heard from them, and what is it that they're not doing to relieve that pressure on our teaching staff?
Representative Edelson.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, I think you're bringing up a good question. Special education teachers are an absolute asset, especially if we want to deliver the service. For context, 300 forms are required between the federal and state government for special education teachers to fill out for a student. Now, other educators are not required to do that. They are a special category, I think, in and of themselves, which is why we're creating special legislation to make sure that we're addressing the needs. I know that Mr. Uni is present. I don't know if he wants to speak to maybe any issues that they've, or communication they've had with the Department of Education on special education paperwork. I know it's been an issue since I've been elected, so 4 years, and I've been working with our congressional team to see if we can do anything about it.
Mr. Uni, I don't know if you had a comment.
Madam Chair, representatives, thanks for the opportunity to weigh in here. This is a really important conversation, and overall really speaks to the need for more resourcing in this space to support our students and our families and our educators and our schools. But to the direct question, I think this kind of refers to the work Representative Erickson pointed out, that the legislature's been looking at this for some time. The LLA came out with a report in 2013, and I believe there was some legislation in 2019, and we've been engaged in some activities since then that I'm happy to share with the with the committee about activities that we've been doing. But just overarching comments is we're always looking at ways to provide better guidance and assistance for our districts and our educators to be able to improve their processes. I will remind the committee that a lot of the requirements are from the feds. So we look at what we can do in the state space. And then we do also find that sometimes districts do end up adding on some paperwork for whatever reasons they feel see fit, but we do strive to be able to identify ways that districts can support their educators and their families with reduced paperwork burden. But some of the other areas that we've been able to look at, I'm just, you know, pardon me, I'm just reading off of some of the notes that I have here, but, you know, MDE rolled out a kind of skinny total special education system template that hopefully ease duplicative or unnecessary efforts associated with districts creating a full total special education system. This process can often be a heavy paperwork burden, so we saw an opportunity to provide an easier compiled template. We did meet with some stakeholders from a range of groups that allowed for the functional behavioral assessment to be conducted as a standalone assessment rather than as part of a comprehensive evaluation. A rule change occurred that reduced the need for short-term assessment and IEPs. We convened a working group, developed guidance around changes to conciliation conference language that would allow a parent to request a conciliation conference rather than being a requirement. We convened a prior written notice working group, which included representatives from a range of groups. This group found that many schools were including information in the prior written notice that was not required by state or federal law. And then our work providing special education program monitoring for districts, which did begin in summer of 2016, did help reduce monitor districts' record review requirements by around 25% to 30%. Over districts who did not receive the monitoring assistance. And then our program staff, as I mentioned earlier, are always monitoring the reporting work done by districts, and we're constantly suggesting administrative improvements. Saying all of that, there are always ways to improve and continue to partner with the legislature and with districts to ease the burdens on our educators and for the better service for our students and our families.
Thank you, Mr. Oney. Representative Erickson, any follow-up?
Yeah, just to Mr. Oney. So thank you for telling us that. So what is the problem here? What because some of the things that you have delineated sound like they may have reduced the paperwork requirement, but, you know, where are we going astray here and putting all of this pressure on our special education staff and teachers to spend all that time with paperwork?
Mr. Oney.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, I will note that we are engaged in a lot of activities, but we are limited in what we are able to reduce. A lot of these are around monitor suggestions and technical assistance, but sometimes certain situations in districts, because they're presented with different situations, do provide different situations where they may see fit to have different paperwork or there's different challenges. We may not get to every situation. Our guidance may not match every situation where there is. There's always areas for improvement. And we are doing as much as we're able to under our current authority right now. But I think as you've seen from this conversation, there are always areas to improve. There are always challenges. And I'll just go back to my overarching comments at the top. There are always opportunities. This always just highlights more opportunities for providing more resources in this space.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Any follow-up from that?
No, Madam Chair, thank you.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Ellison, for bringing this bill. I think it's important. I think that anytime we can help alleviate some of the stress and the pressures on our special education teachers, we should do that. You know, I know that the issue was raised around local control and collective bargaining. You know, the fact of the matter is our students need to have as much direct services as possible. And when our special education teachers are spending a large chunk of their time working on IEPs and administration and paperwork, they cannot provide those services. So our students are losing out. We should do everything we can to make sure our students do not lose out. We've got a strike going on right now in Minneapolis because our educators are fighting for having more resources and support for our students so that they can have the best possible outcomes that they deserve. I think this bill goes towards working towards that goal. I'm looking forward to supporting it. So thank you for bringing it.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. Seeing no other member hands, Representative Edelson, I will give you closing comments on your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to just address, I know that, you know, 300 forms is a lot. And it's just hearing about the number. But the reality is a lot of those forms are in place for a reason. They're there for protections. And so I know it's always, how do we reduce the amount of paperwork? I agree to some extent, can we streamline it? But also, we have come a far way in making sure that kids with special education or with disabilities have the care and the services they need. So how do we do that and also retain our amazing special education teachers? I cannot tell you the experiences we've had. So many amazing special education teachers we have in the state, and it's not only in my district. So I think every single one of you have them in your, well, you do, whether or not you know them, they're there, and we need to have really good discussions about what we're going to do about them working evenings and weekends. That's not okay. And I know that this is a bipartisan issue that we don't want our teachers working that much. So I ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Edelson. Representative Edelson renews the motion to refer House File 4233 to the Committee on Education Finance. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Richardson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hassan?
Aye.
Representative Erickson?
No.
Representative Bennett?
No.
Representative Berg?
Aye.
Representative Bowe?
Bowe votes no.
Representative Christensen?
Aye.
Representative Drazkowski? Representative Edelson?
Aye.
Representative Feist?
Aye.
Representative Frazier?
Aye.
Representative Jordan?
Aye.
Representative Keeler?
Aye.
Representative Moeller?
Aye.
Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes no.
Representative Poston?
No.
Representative Scott?
No.
Representative Erdahl?
Aye.
Representative Wozlowick?
Wozlowick, aye.
Representative Drazkowski? Madam Chair, there are 12 ayes, 6 nays, and 1 absent vote.
With a vote of 12 ayes and 6 nays, the motion prevails and the bill is referred to the Committee on Education Finance. Up next, we have House File 3401. Members, we will not be taking action on House File 3401 or the DE amendments today. We'll be hearing a walkthrough of the bill from House Research, and then it will be followed by public testimony on the bill. When we meet again on Friday, we'll move the bill to be before us, adopt the DE amendment before working through any amendments to the amendment that are submitted. Ms. Pera, please proceed with the walkthrough of the DE amendment to House File 3401.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Article 1 of the DE is the general education article. Section 1 replaces Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day on the list of holidays that a school district may conduct school. It requires at least 1 hour of the school program that day to be devoted to observance of the day and lists topics that the district may cover with teachers or students. Section 2 allows the school board to designate a facility or program within a facility or district as an education site. Section 3 increases the maximum amount a school board member who is employed by the district may earn from that employment from $8,000 to $20,000. Section 4 and the next several sections all amend the Online Learning Options Act, and these provisions go into effect in the 23-24 school year and later. So Section 4 modifies definitions related to online learning, in particular distinguishing supplemental online learning from other types of online learning, such as when a district provides online learning to its enrolled students. Section 5 allows districts to offer digital learning to its enrolled students without the review and reporting requirements that apply to other online learning providers. And those would not generate online learning funds. Section 6 modifies requirements relating to accessing online learning, including those relating to computer hardware and locations where the student may participate, and requires that online learning curriculum be aligned with state standards. Section 7 requires a supplemental online learning provider to notify the commissioner that it is delivering online learning and report the number of students it accepts
and online learning courses and programs it delivers. It also requires a district providing online learning to enrolled students to create an online learning site and report the students enrolled at that site. Section 8, this section does go into effect the day following final enactment, unlike the other sections. It defines crisis online learning, crisis learning period, and crisis online learning plan. It requires a plan to describe how crisis online learning and critical components of education will be provided and meet certain other requirements. Section 9 modifies the description of what's known as SLIFE students. That's students who qualify as English learners with limited or interrupted formal education based on the amount of formal education they have when they enter school in the United States. Section 10, then the students that previously qualified as SLIFE under the old definition, those students would continue to qualify for the graduation incentives program, specifically for the early middle college program. Section 11 modifies the definition of American Indian student for purposes of the American Indian Education Act. It uses the state definition, which allows students who would otherwise be counted in the two or more races category to continue to be counted as American Indian, which is why the state count is larger than the federal count. Section 12 requires the commissioner to use an annual report of American Indian student data that uses the state count when providing technical assistance. Section 13 requires the state count to be used to determine whether a district, charter school, or tribal contract school is eligible for American Indian aid. Section 14 specifies how the state determines the state-identified American Indian student count. Section 15 allows a district or charter school to use an online learning program to fulfill its duties to provide special education services to a child placed in a care and treatment facility. Section 16 similarly, it's for children with disabilities, without disabilities, and allows the serving school district or charter school to use online learning to fulfill its duties if the child or the child's parents agree to that form of instruction. Section 17 allows a district to use its state-approved online learning program to fulfill its duties to provide special education services to a child placed in a residential facility. If the child is enrolled in a charter school, that charter school can also use online learning to fulfill its responsibilities. Article 2 is the Education Excellence article. Section 1 allows educational data to be disclosed to tribal nations about tribally enrolled or descendant students. Section 2 requires student records transmitted when a student transfers schools to include pupil withdrawals and services the student needs to prevent inappropriate behavior from recurring. Section 3 adds ethnic studies to the list of subject areas in which all students must receive instruction. Section 4 adds art to the list of required statewide standards. Currently, art standards are adopted at the district level. Section 5 requires art standards to be adopted at the state level and adds media arts as a fifth art area. Schools have to offer at least 3 and require at least 2 areas at the elementary and middle school level, and offer at least 3 and require at least 1 for high school students. Section 6 requires the commissioner to consider advice from additional stakeholders when revising standards. Those additional stakeholders are representatives from the Tribal Nations Education Committee and Minnesota's Tribal Nations and Communities, district and charter school students and K through 12, and other stakeholders representing the ethnic, racial, and geographic diversity of Minnesota, including diversity of gender and sexual orientation, immigrant status, and religious and linguistic background. Section 7 clarifies the commissioner's authority to amend rules on academic standards. Section 8 requires Indigenous education standards that include the contributions of American Indian tribes and communities to be embedded into the state's academic standards and graduation requirements, requires the commissioner to embed ethnic studies into state standards, and delays the review of physical education standards by 4 years. Section 9 requires a district to regularly review its career and technical education standards, and requires the standards to align with Minnesota CTE frameworks. standards by national CTE education organizations or required industry standards. Section 10, again, requires the arts credit to satisfy state rather than local standards. It requires students beginning ninth grade in the 23-24 school year and later to have a course for credit in government and citizenship in grade 11 or 12, and to have complete a personal finance course for credit during their senior year. Section 11 modifies a reference to a school's agriculture program to include food and natural resources education, and it changes a reference to the administrative rule that doesn't apply, that part is the rule on an instructor passing licensure exams for the credit to be granted. Section 12 defines ethnic studies curriculum. Section 13 strikes language encouraging schools not to exclude students in kindergarten through grade 5 from recess as punishment or discipline. Section 14 adds definitions to the World's Best Workforce Statute. There are definitions of ethnic studies curriculum, anti-racist, culturally sustaining, institutional racism, and on track for graduation. Section 15 adds performance measures in a district's World's Best Workforce Plan to include participation in honors or gifted and talented programming and students on track for graduation. It requires districts starting the 23-24 school year to report on participation and performance on advanced placement, international baccalaureate, and dual enrollment programs, and that reporting to be done for student subgroups. Section 16 requires districts' World's Best Workforce Plans to include ethnic studies curriculum and anti-racist and culturally sustaining curriculum, and modifies other plan requirements. Section 17 requires districts' advisory committee to recommend strategies regarding curriculum and learning and work environments. Section 18 establishes a new grant program, the Closing Educational Opportunity Gaps Grants, which would be administered by the Commissioner of Education, and requires grants to be used to support efforts that close opportunity gaps in specified ways. Section 19 requires services in addition to programs in the Gifted and Talented Statute. It requires identification assessments and procedures to be sensitive and equitable to underrepresented groups and be coordinated for optimal identification of programs and services for underrepresented groups. Section 20 modifies the attendance measure used in the statewide reporting system from average daily attendance to consistent attendance and substitutes ACT for the American College Test. Section 21 strikes definitions related to adaptive assessments in above grade level or below grade level questions. Section 22 modifies the date by which a district or charter school must publish its testing calendar. Section 23 modifies the use of growth measures and the demographic categories for student data reporting. Section 24 strikes growth targets from the list of actions the department undertakes. Section 25 prohibits a district from adopting a name, symbol, or image of an American Indian tribe, custom, or tradition as the mascot, nickname, logo, letterhead, or team name of a district or school. There's a process to seek an exemption. Section 26 defines the Minnesota multi-tiered systems of support as a system continuous improvement framework for ensuring positive social, emotional, behavioral, developmental, and academic outcomes for every student, and it lists required components of the framework. Section 27 modifies the definition of dismissal to include out-of-school suspensions, but not in-school suspensions. Section 28 then defines, currently there's only a definition for suspensions. Section 28 defines in-school suspensions and separately out-of-school suspensions. Section 29 defines non-exclusionary disciplinary policies and practices. Section 30 defines a pupil withdrawal agreement and limits those agreements to 12 months. Section 31 prohibits dismissal of a student in kindergarten through grade 3 unless non-exclusionary discipline measures have been exhausted and there is an ongoing serious safety threat to the child or others. Section 32 requires the school to use non-exclusionary disciplinary policies and practices before dismissal proceedings or pupil withdrawal agreements. Section 33 requires schools to provide alternative education services to students who are suspended more than 5 consecutive school days. Section 34 requires school officials to give suspended students the opportunity to complete all schoolwork assigned during the suspension and receive full credit for the assignments. It encourages a principal to designate a school employee as a liaison to work with the teachers to allow the student to receive course materials and complete assignments, receive feedback. Section 35 requires the written notice of intent to impose an expulsion to describe the non-exclusionary discipline policies and practices offered the student to avoid the expulsion. Section 36 requires an admission or readmission plan to include measures to improve the student's behavior and lists optional elements of the plan. It requires the plan to include parental involvement in the admission or readmission process. Section 37 requires districts to report on pupil withdrawal agreements and non-exclusionary disciplinary practices to the commissioner. Section 38 requires school discipline policies to include non-exclusionary disciplinary policies and practices, and schools to make sure that students who have been expelled or excluded or withdrawn are on track for readmission and have information on accessing mental health services. Section 39 requires a discipline policy to contain a procedure to file a complaint regarding the application of discipline policies and seek corrective action. Section 40 requires a policy to include procedures to ensure victims of bullying who respond with behavior that's not allowed have access to a remedial response consistent with the bullying statute, prohibits the use of exclusionary practices for early learners, and prohibit the use of exclusionary practices to address the tendency and truancy. Section 41 requires the discipline policy to have procedures for students, parents, and other guardians and school staff to file a complaint and seek corrective action when the discipline statutes are not being implemented appropriately, and requires policy to have specific components. Section 42 prohibits a teacher, school employee, or agent of the district or charter school from excluding a student in elementary school from participating in recess to punish or discipline the student. Section 43 prohibits a post-secondary institution participating in PSEO from requiring a faith statement for a PSEO student during the application process or basing admissions decisions on the student's race, creed, ethnicity, disability, gender, or sexual orientation, or religious beliefs or affiliations. Section 44 eliminates limits on when a post-secondary institution can provide information to high school students and parents, advertise, recruit, or solicit high school students to enroll in the institution's courses. Section 45 requires a high school and post-secondary institution that enrolls students in concurrent enrollment courses to report to the commissioner the participation rates of students in the courses. Section 46 requires the school board to adopt the same weighted grade point average policy for credits earned through PSEO as it does for credits earned through concurrent enrollment. Section 47 reduces the withdrawal and absence periods from the first 14 to the first 10 business days of the term, which accelerates the time that the department stops payment to the post-secondary institution when a student withdraws or stops attending class. Section 48 eliminates that provision that allows a student to participate in a learning year program and accelerate attainment of grade level or graduation requirements. Section 49 clarifies that American Indian education programs are designed to support American Indian students and modifies the description of instruction in American Indian language, literature, history, and culture. Section 58 limits enrollment in American Indian education programs on a shared time basis to only American Indian children. Section 51 modifies the settings where American Indian education programs may be offered on a daily basis. Section 52 requires a district or tribal contract school that conducts American Indian education programs under the American Indian Education Act and serves 100 or more state-identified American Indian students to provide American Indian culture and language classes. Section 53 requires districts and tribal contract schools to employ dedicated American Indian education program coordinators rather than community coordinators or Indian homeschool liaisons. Section 54 amends the Parent and Community Participation Statute. It modifies requirements relating to the American Indian Parent Advisory Committee's vote of concurrence or non-concurrence. Eligibility modifies eligibility for membership in the committee and establishes how the count of state-identified American Indian students is determined. Section 55 modifies the duties of the American Indian Director and references to parties with whom the director must work collaboratively and in conjunction with. Section 56 requires a district or charter school to allow an American Indian student to wear American Indian regalia, tribal regalia, or objects of cultural significance at graduation ceremonies. Section 57 clarifies that charter schools may receive American Indian education aid. Section 58 strikes the word pilot from the description of American Indian education programs. Section 59 modifies achievement and integration plan requirements. It requires the plans to include strategies to validate, affirm, embrace, and integrate cultural and community strengths and to address institutional racism. It requires districts to use local data to the extent practicable to develop plan components and strategies. It requires districts to implement interventions to eliminate academic disparities for students impacted by racial, gender, linguistic, and economic inequities. Section 60 broadens the application of restrictive procedure statutes from only students with disabilities to all students. Section 61 broadens the role of the Oversight Committee to review the use of restrictive procedures for disproportionality, racial disparities, the usage of restrictive procedures, involvement of school resource officers, student documentation, whether staff followed appropriate standards, and whether restrictive procedures are contraindicated for the student. Section 62 modifies the requirement for an IEP meeting, depending on whether a student is a student with a disability. Section 63 requires a debriefing process following the use of restrictive procedure. Section 64 allows an American Indian student to carry a medicine pouch containing loose tobacco intended in observance of traditional, spiritual, or cultural practices, and defines an American Indian as a person having origins in any of the original peoples of North America who maintain cultural identification through tribal affiliation or community recognition. Section 65 requires districts and schools selected to participate in the National Assessment of Educational Progress or similar assessments to do so. Section 66 is an instruction to the reviser to renumber the provisions relating to statewide assessments and reporting requirements. And Section 67 repeals a statute relating to students with emotional or behavioral disorders. Pause for just a minute. Okay, Article 3, teachers. Section 1 increases, sets a goal for increasing the percentage of teachers of color and American Indian teachers in Minnesota. The purpose is to set the state goal to increase the percentage of teachers of color and American Indian teachers and ensure all students have access to effective and diverse teachers who reflect the diversity of students by 2040. It requires the Professional Educator Licensing Standards Board, PELSB, to report on outcomes of state programs related to the preparation or retention of diverse teachers. Section 2 requires the school board to adopt a written policy that prohibits discrimination or discipline for a teacher or a principal for incorporating into the curriculum contributions by persons in a protected class. Section 3 requires PELSB to identify a teacher shortage area based on the number of assignments a district is unable to fill with a licensed teacher by November 1 of every even-numbered year, the number of out-of-field permissions issued, and the number of Tier 1 licenses issued and license fields board-approved preparation programs. Section 4 requires PELSB's supply and demand report to include district data on the number of teachers hired in the preceding 2 years, the number of teachers hired holding a license at each tier level, and the number of assignments the district was unable to fill with a licensed teacher, and licenses and permissions for license field with a board-approved preparation program. Section 5 requires the Board of School Administrators to adopt rules that require school administrators renewing a license to have at least 2 hours of mental illness training, including at least 1 hour of suicide prevention training, and one additional hour on specified topics. Section 6 eliminates the exclusion of Tier 1 teachers from the definition of teacher, which would allow the Tier 1 teachers to be in the same bargaining unit as other teachers. Section 7 requires PELSB to issue a Tier 3 license to a candidate who either completed a teacher preparation program from a culturally specific minority serving institution and is eligible for a teacher license in another state, or completed a university teacher preparation program in another country, has taught for at least 2 years, as long as the candidate has completed student teaching comparable to Minnesota requirements. Section 8 allows a candidate for a Tier 4 license to meet teaching experience requirement with experience in another state. Section 9 modifies the teacher licensure tests. Paragraphs A and B strike the skills test requirement for the Tier 4 license. They eliminate the Tier 3 and 4 pedagogy and content exam requirements for candidates who have completed a board-approved preparation program and who have completed teacher preparation programs in other states where they passed licensure examinations. It requires PELSI to adopt rules for a performance assessment to be used in place of an examination. Paragraph C requires testing centers to provide monthly opportunities for untimed content and pedagogy exams, and it requires a candidate that has not passed the exam after two attempts to be allowed to retake the exam for free. Section 10 requires the district to report all new teacher hires and terminations by race and ethnicity annually to the Department of Education. You'll see this again just a little bit. This part applies to districts and cities outside the first class. Section 11 modifies the probationary period for a teacher who has taught for 3 consecutive years in a single district or charter school in Minnesota or another state by allowing the teacher to obtain continuing contract status after serving a 1-year probationary period rather than 3-year. And Section 13, I'll just say now, is the same language, but for districts and cities of the first class. Section 12 and 14, again, one is for districts in the first class, the other one districts outside. This requires districts to use the rubric or performance standards for teacher practice that includes teacher responsiveness and to have common descriptions of effectiveness using at least 3 levels of performance. Section 15 is that reporting to the Department of Education of teachers' hires and terminations. Section 16 requires collective bargaining agreements for teachers to include provisions for due process forms and procedures for teachers working with students receiving special education services. It has default language that would apply if the parties can't come to an agreement. Section 17 modifies the Collaborative Urban and Greater Minnesota Educators of Color Grant Program. Modifies the purpose of the grant, the requirements for applicants, their plans for how they will use grant funds, modifies the priority order for criteria, and how PELSI administers the grant. Section 18 modifies the use of teacher mentorship grant funds, requires PELSI to prioritize grants for efforts to induct, mentor, and retain Tier 2 or 3 teachers who are of color or American Indian, and Tier 2 or 3 teachers in licensure shortage areas. Allows the grants to be awarded for up to 24 months. Section 19 requires principal evaluations to support and improve principals' culturally responsive leadership practices. Section 20 requires PELSI in its teacher supply and demand report for 2023 to report the number of teacher openings by school district for teachers with licenses in specified fields. And for each field, the report must include the number of teachers hired by district at each license level and the number of teacher assignments the district was unable to fill with a licensed teacher. Article 4 is charter schools. Section 1 has new definitions for charter management organization, education management organization, market need and demand study, and online education service provider. Section 2 requires charter schools to comply with the statute on alternatives to suspension. Section 3 requires charter schools to comply with the Education for English Learners Act. Section 4 makes the term of a charter school authorizer open-ended instead of being limited to 5 years. Section 5 amends the authorizer withdrawal requirements. Section 6 requires an authorizer application to include a market need and demand study and strikes the requirement that the application include a statement of assurances of legal compliance. Section 7 requires an authorizer's affidavit to include a market need and demand study. Section 8 requires an authorizer approving a school's application to add grades or primary enrollment sites to include a market need and demand study. Section 9 requires a teacher serving on a charter school board of directors to meet the definition of a licensed teacher. Section 10 requires charter school admission to be free to a resident of Minnesota and gives enrollment preference to Minnesota residents over out-of-state residents. It requires students enrolled in a charter school's pre-K program to apply for entry into kindergarten without receiving enrollment preference. It also modifies admissions preferences for charter schools that serve at least 90% of enrolled students who are eligible for special education services and have a primary disability of deaf, hard of hearing, or deafblind. That enrollment preference, the charter school will be able to give those students that enrollment preference to students who have the same primary disability, but the school would not be able to limit admission based on the child's eligibility for other special education services. Section 11 requires a charter school to lease space from the owner of the space rather than subleasing the space. Section 12 prohibits an affiliated building corporation from supporting more than one charter school. Section 13 requires a charter management organization or educational management organization to submit an audit report to the commissioner annually. And Section 14 strikes an obsolete reference to a chapter on cooperatives. Article 5, health and safety. Section 1 strongly encourages school districts and charter schools to provide substance misuse awareness and prevention instruction at least once to students in grade 6 through 8, and instruction must be evidence-based. There's also instruction for the younger students. Sections 2 and 3 of the student bullying statute. Section 2 strikes language encouraging districts and schools to provide instruction to reduce prohibited conduct and take other actions, and it replaces encouragement with a requirement that districts engage students in creating a safe and supportive school environment to take other actions. Section 3 requires the commissioner to develop procedures for reviewing district and school programs and policies on evidence-based social-emotional learning, maintain resources to help schools implement strategies to create a positive school climate and use evidence-based social-emotional learning to prevent and reduce discrimination and other improper conduct. And it requires, the commissioner to adopt learning standards. Section 4 defines malicious and sadistic conduct and requires school boards to prohibit malicious and sadistic conduct involving race, religion, disability, sexual harassment, sexual orientation, and sexual exploitation by a district or school staff member or student against another staff or student. This new statute references the student bullying statute and defines malicious and sadistic conduct as creating a hostile learning environment by acting with the intent to cause harm, by intentionally injuring another without just cause or reason, or engaging in extreme or excessive cruelty or delighting in cruelty. Section 5, to the extent a school board or charter school receives non-public funds or in-kind contributions for posters with the National Child Abuse Hotline number, it must display the posters in each building or otherwise provide students notice of the hotline number. Section 6 requires school districts and charter schools to maintain a supply of opiate antagonists at each site. Article 6 is the nutrition and libraries article. And there are a number of sections that I will just describe at once here, but they changed a reference to free or reduced price lunch to free or reduced price meals. So that is section 1, 2, and I'll come back to that then. Section 3 is the summer food service program and child and adult care food program. Subdivision 1 is a technical change, and subdivision 2 limits how often legally distinct CACFP and SFSP program sites can transfer sponsoring organizations to just once per year. Subdivision 3 requires a non-governmental organization to provide documentation to the department, verifying that staff members have completed program-specific training before applying to sponsor CACFP and SFSP program site. Subdivision 4 prohibits the department from approving a new SFSP site that is within a half mile of an existing site unless the new program will not serve the same group of children for the same type. And then coming back here to that change from lunch to meals. We'll see that in sections 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10, 11, 12. There may be more. Section 9 is school libraries that list the characteristics of a school library or school library media center. Section 13 substitutes resident for citizen in a provision regarding the responsibility of the state to provide library services. Section 14 is a technical change to the name of National Library Service. Section 15 substitutes English language learners for Spanish speaking in the list of examples of innovative and experimental library programs. Section 16 requires regional library basic system support aid recipients to comply with reduced maintenance of effort requirements. And then the remaining sections 17 through 20 are again changing from lunch to meals. And that is the DE, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Parra, for that walkthrough. It's quite a bit, and so we appreciate your efforts on that and all the work that you and staff put into this as well. Up next, we have Commissioner Mueller. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Heather Mueller, and I have the pleasure of serving as the Commissioner of Education. Thank you for the opportunity to share my support for your education policy omnibus bill. I first want to thank you for including so many provisions for the Governor and Lieutenant Governor's policy bill, which is predicated on our Due North Education Plan and seeks to work toward the goal that every child receives a high-quality education, no matter their race or zip code. The proposals in this bill focus on centering the whole child in all that we do and builds Minnesota's world-class education through a safe and welcoming environment with caring and qualified teachers so that students as unique individuals are seen, valued, and heard as they come into our school buildings every day. I want to highlight some of the importance of a few of the packages in my comments today. I support the chair's prioritization of next generation disciplinary approaches. We know that students need to be in the classroom to succeed academically. Every minute that students miss of instruction, especially the on time and in order science of literacy in early grades, has a detrimental impact on their learning and subsequent achievement. This is why extending the prohibition of suspensions, except in rare circumstances, to serve to our students in kindergarten through grade 3 is critical to the academic, mental, behavioral, and social emotional trajectories of our youngest learners. The implementation of system-wide non-exclusionary discipline practices, a package the department has proposed for several years, is paramount to keeping students in the school setting and committing to their success and closing the achievement gap. This policy language works in tandem with investments made by the legislature and by the governor to support professional development in non-exclusionary discipline practices, alternatives to suspensions, and model discipline policies. Creating a safe and welcoming environment also requires providing programs and supports where students see themselves in their education and feel protected. Thank you for including ethnic studies and Indigenous Education for All in our academic standards. We have begun the work of filling staff supports funded during the last legislative session, and this will embed the fabric of our increasingly diverse state across all of our academic standards. I also appreciate the inclusion of all the past due proposals for American Indian education, from honoring students' right to wear items of cultural significance at graduation ceremonies, banning mascots depicting American Indians, and creating Indigenous Peoples Day, to empowering American Indian parent advisory committees, allowing data sharing with tribal nations, and using the state count for American Indian students. All of these take the necessary steps towards supporting some of our most underserved students. Caring and qualified teachers is another prong in meeting the needs of our students, and we know that supported teachers provide a stronger teaching and learning environment, and students need to see themselves in who is teaching them. And when students learn from diverse learners, all students benefit. I am thankful that this bill builds upon the funding passed last session by establishing a goal for a more diverse teaching workforce and embeds cultural competency expectations for our educators across a range of statutory programs. I'm thankful for the work of the Teachers of Color and American Indian Teachers Coalition in this space. We are grateful for their partnership and their dedication to increasing the number of racially and ethnically diverse teachers in our classrooms, and that these classrooms foster culturally inclusive practices. I also appreciate supports like protecting educators who teach about federally protected classes of people, eliminating the basic skills test for teacher licensure, and allowing for flexibility in the composition of all teacher license exams. There are so many other provisions in this bill that allow for our students to have a world-class education and succeed academically, like a multi-tiered system of support, creating stronger expectations to support students' social-emotional learning, a range of improvements for charter schools like market need and demand studies and stronger oversight of CMOs and EMOs, allowing all districts and charters to provide online learning, and modernizing the definition for students who are also SLIFE. This bill acknowledges and honors the diversity of our students, families, and staff by keeping students in the classroom through alternatives to suspension, creating opportunities for all students to see themselves in what they are learning, diversifying the teaching profession, promoting a range of other worthy policies that seek to increase transparency and accountability. And I believe we have many shared goals and an opportunity to act boldly to enact common sense policy changes. Thank you again for the opportunity to offer my support for this bill.
Thank you for your testimony, Commissioner. Moving on to public testimony, we are going to begin with Zeke Jackson, the Executive Director for People for PSEO. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you so much for your support of the PSEO program this session. With me, I have Beatrice, the Vice President of People for PSEO, and Ronnie, the President of the U of M Student Association. We're heading over, we're on the light rail right now, heading over to the Capitol to testify for the Senate version of this bill. And so this is something that's really, really important to PSEO students and alumni. We're working really hard for it, and we hope to work with you and others in the future to continue expanding the PSEO program to make sure it's effectively serving the students in this state. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Matt Shaver, Policy Director with EdAllies. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Richardson, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Matt Shaver, Policy Director at EdAllies, a statewide education advocacy nonprofit that works in partnership to ensure every student has access to a rigorous and engaging education. Thank you for the opportunity to share some thoughts on House File 3401 as amended. Thank you to Chair Richardson for your leadership of this committee. I want to start by highlighting a number of great policies we strongly support. A ban on pre-K through 3 dismissals, which would protect our youngest learners, requiring schools to use non-exclusionary discipline practices, and expanding parental notification rights for parents of students who are suspended. Expansion of college and career readiness measures in World's Best Workforce to include participation in rigorous coursework by student group and the addition of a ninth grade on track for graduation indicator. Creating a common and comprehensive definition of teacher shortages so that we can use data to target resources and better track our progress toward actually eliminating those shortages. Eliminating the PSEO gag rule so that our high school students have complete and accurate information about the benefits and opportunities PSEO provides. Prioritizing funding for programs that provide culturally responsive mentorship, induction, and retention for Tier 2 and Tier 3 teachers and teachers in shortage areas to ensure that they are supported and successful for our students. Reporting on hires and terminations by race and ethnicity, which will give us clearer insight into the what and why and how of teacher churn, particularly for teachers of color. We'd like to see assurances that this report would separate out terminations from layoffs, as well as from teachers leaving on their own. While we strongly support issuing Tier 3 licenses to educators who have completed teacher prep at culturally specific minority-serving institutions and those who are prepared and taught abroad, we do have questions about the impact of needing to have student teaching experiences, quote, comparable to the student teaching expectations in Minnesota. With different student teaching requirements from state to state, not to mention country to country, are we unintentionally creating a barrier with this proposed standard to meet? Finally, we're grateful to the committee for allowing laws passed last year to increase authorizer accountability to take effect and for not including harmful changes to tiered licensure that would disproportionately affect teachers of color. Thank you for your time today, and thank you all for your public service to our state.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Kevian Ellis, Policy Strategist for Education Minnesota. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. Kevian Ellis with Education Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to share some comments, and thank you, committee, for your work on this bill. There's a lot of good things in here, but I'll just highlight a few. Namely, we're happy to see the language that adequately defines multi-tiered systems of support. This enhanced definition will allow districts to identify tools to better ensure the needs of the whole child are aligned through supports on both the academic and social emotional learning side. In addition, the language regarding a ban on pre-K through 3 dismissals will help end racial disparities in student discipline that disproportionately impacts students of color and students with disabilities. Students can't learn if they're not in the classroom in this language, along with resources for training on non-exclusionary practices, will ensure that students remain in the classroom while maintaining the safety of all students and school staff. Also, thank you for including Rep. Keeler's bill on including Indigenous Peoples Day on the list of holidays that a district may conduct school. By passing this language, we are acknowledging the important contributions of Native American history and its people. Lastly, I'll note that we support getting rid of the racially biased teachers' skills test or exams, which are an unnecessary barrier to teachers seeking to attain higher licensure. So thank you for including that in this bill as well. With that, again, thank you, committee, for allowing me to provide testimony today.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Richard Terrell, interventionist and equity specialist for Eastern Carver County Schools. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Richardson and the members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Richard Terrell. I'm currently working with Eastern Carver County Schools in Chaska, Minnesota as an intervention equity specialist. And today I'm testifying on behalf of Educators for Excellence, Minnesota. I've been in education for 10 years, working in various roles, paraprofessional, dean of students, intervention and culture specialist, mainly working on behavior intervention and supporting teachers with classroom management. About 4 years ago, I started working with a seventh grader, a Black young man. He was diagnosed with a learning disability in third grade and was evaluated for special education in fourth grade for a social and emotional disorder. During our first interaction, he told me that teachers looked at him differently, treated him differently, and just had low expectations for him. He got suspended many times for behavior that was perceived disrespectful. After our first interaction, I quickly noticed that this young man was bright. He was a caregiver, loving and honest. He just wanted to be seen and heard. As we got to know each other, set goals, and got his parents involved, everyone noticed a shift in him. His grades started to improve. He got involved in extracurricular activities and was shown signs of getting out of special education, which he did when he got into high school. My ability to relate to him on a personal level greatly impacted his success. My mentoring and understanding allowed him to begin thinking about college, and we still communicate to this day. I share this story today to highlight two key issues that this bill would address. First, the student experienced disparities in discipline that affected him in a negative way. Because of this, it is essential to pass this bill and work to end harmful practices so that many Black and brown students that so many Black and brown students experience. Second, when teachers of colors are in the classroom, all students benefit, but especially Black and brown students. There are many kids that have the same story as this one that I just told, but they don't have teachers that can relate to him. This bill includes important provisions to help recruit and retain teachers of color. These provisions are essential, and I know that your support of this bill will make a huge difference in the lives of many students in Minnesota. So thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Caitlin Snyder with Education Minnesota.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Caitlin Snyder with Education Minnesota. We'd really like to thank you for bringing forward a bill today that includes incredibly strong provisions for our students of color and our American Indian students. First, we appreciate the inclusion of ethnic studies as a required part of the bill. Kids shouldn't have to go through 13 years of public school without seeing their contributions reflected in their classes. We appreciate the support to support our American Indian students, including the cultural practices like sacred tobacco, protecting the student count for all American Indian programs, and sharing data with our sovereign tribal nations on American Indian students. We also support the language in the bill that will make sure that our Black, Indigenous, people of color kids have higher expectations from their administrators by making sure that our principals are receiving mental health training and that our principals are receiving culturally responsiveness in their principal evaluation. We also appreciate the supports for some of our most vulnerable educators, like allowing our tier one teachers to join the union. Right now, these teachers cannot bargain for professional development. They cannot decline additional assignments like working with the student council or other additional assignments without being worried that they're going to lose their job. We also heard about the importance of due process time earlier in committee, so I won't belabor the point, but kids need this time in order to be receiving their services, so we appreciate the inclusion here. There were a couple of items that we had hoped to see in today's bill, including a bill from Representative Feist that had some provisions relating to building subs. And we will submit some further written testimony before the hearing on Friday, but we really appreciate the items that have been brought forward by the committee. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Maren Holden with Legal Services Advocacy Project and Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you so much, Chair Richardson and members. My name is Maren Holden, and I'm an attorney at Legal Aid, which includes the Minnesota Disability Law Center. We're also part of the Solutions Not Suspensions Coalition, which is a coalition of students, families, community members, and organizations committed to ending the pervasive racial and disability disparities and exclusionary discipline in Minnesota, and instead foster positive school climates for all students. As you've heard from other testifiers, there are many great discipline provisions in this bill, and Legal Aid submitted a letter in your materials that highlights multiple things that we're excited about. But I wanted to specifically highlight one thing. The district complaint process for discipline in school district policies, it's at lines 54 and pages 54 and 56. One of the reasons that we find suspensions to be so harmful is that they can really hurt the relationship between the student and the family and the school by saying, you don't belong here. And one of the things we hear frequently is that this is made worse when families discover that if they believe their child was not suspended in accordance with discipline policy or state law, they have no recourse. There's no mechanism in the Pupil Fair Dismissal Act for families to appeal or seek a correction if suspension procedures weren't followed. And Minnesota courts have said that families can't seek recourse there either. I've had countless conversations with families who are already feeling disconnected with their school and have lost trust. And then learning that there is nothing that can be done if they believe a suspension has been imposed improperly can make them feel hopeless. Sections 39 and 41 of Article 2 would add to what's already required to be in school district policies to ensure that districts have a process for families to ask that an imposed suspension be looked into further and potentially corrected if it's decided that it wasn't applied in accordance with the school policy or law. This is a really great approach because it will help families not feel so powerless, which often makes their relationship with school and their students' experience better when they don't feel that way. It will also help districts have more conversations and reflections about their discipline practices in the context of their specific district. One other thing I'll quickly note is that this bill also requires district discipline policies to not permit dismissals for truancy or attendance, which is just common sense. The goal should be to have students in school more, not less. Thank you so much, Chair Richardson, for including this and so many other provisions. And thank you, members, for the time today.
Thank you for your testimony. So members, as a reminder, on Friday, the meeting will be from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. So it will be a full 2 hours as opposed to our traditional 1.5 hour meeting. The amendment deadline is to have requests submitted to Ms. Para by 5 p.m. on Thursday, March 24th. And on Friday, we will have discussion of the bill and also any amendments to the amendments for the markup of the omnibus bill to be referred to education finance. There being no further business before the committee, we are adjourned.